Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, novelist Jeanette Winterson re-examines Henry Miller's classic Tropic of Cancer.
He was able to write very naturalistically about sex and about relationships. Now, he didn't try and disguise anything, for good or for ill.
Charles McGrath, the Times' writer at large, tells us about a distinguished publisher who's become a confessional poet.
He had always used poetry as a way to explain his own life to himself. And I think a lot of these poems came upon him in a rush.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
For some of us, it's hard to believe, but we've reached just about exactly the 50th anniversary of the publication in the United States, not abroad, of Henry Miller's controversial classic, The Tropic of Cancer, which was one of the, what shall we say, one of the most daring books of its day, and in some ways still enormously provocative. There's a new book about it, about the writing of it. It's by Frederick Turner. It's called Renegade, Henry Miller and the Making of Tropic of Cancer. It's reviewed for us by one of the best novelists in the English language, Jeanette Winterson, and a favorite reviewer of ours. And we're lucky because she's in New York and in the studio to talk with us. Welcome, Jeanette.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, Henry Miller. First of all, tell us, what's your relationship with Henry Miller? You're a pretty daring writer yourself on the subject of sex, and here's one of the major figures, for better or worse. How does he look to you today?
As a writer who's also a woman, I'm both excited and appalled. That's the problem. You want to be able to write about sex. You want that freedom. You want to be able to say everything and to do it imaginatively and bravely. You don't want to be caught. You know, that's something that Erica Jong realized when she wrote a book about Henry Miller called The Devil at Large, where she was really saying, look, I'm Erica Jong, you know, I'm this big feminist, but I couldn't have written Fear of Flying if it hadn't been for Henry Miller writing Tropic of Cancer. She found that that book ripped open her imagination.
And how did it do that, Jeanette? I mean, you're a consequential novelist. You touch on themes, important themes, just as Erica Jong and others do. What was the secret that Henry Miller somehow unlocked?
He was able to write very naturalistically about sex and about relationships. You know, he didn't try and disguise anything, for good or for ill. So you get all of it in there. You get the sex act, you get the emotions that go with it, you get the disgust, you get the humiliation. You know, everything is in there. Of course, all the neurosis and the disturbance is in there as well. But in no way is it prettified. In fact, it's objectified very often. But it gives a writer a certain boldness and a certain feeling of, I really can say anything. Because now there's no place where I have to hide myself. And a writer needs that.
Now, Jeanette, let's get to the appalling side. One reason we put your, what we think is quite an important essay, on the cover of the book review is you have a lot to say about Henry Miller and his relationship to women, not only in his writing but also in his life.
I was looking at the book in the context of the stories that we like to tell ourselves about ourselves, because I don't believe that we have an objective relationship to a text ever. And that's why our readings of text change over the years, although they stay the same. We're always approaching them differently because we are different. So what fascinated me when I was coming back to Tropic of Cancer was not only reading that book, which was written in 1934 and published at the time by a pornographic press in Paris called the Obelisk Press, but also reading reactions about it at the time. What do people think of it? So George Orwell, writing about Henry Miller in 1940, which he did in his essay Inside of a Whale, is very different to Kate Millett, writing about Henry Miller in 1970. And what's happened in between is a sexual revolution and, of course, feminism. So that's going to change the way that we want to think about how men write about women, which, is, of course, is what Miller's doing, because this isn't a democracy in a Henry Miller novel. This is a place where the male is the hero and the women are done unto.
In fact, Jeanette, one of the important points you make is how the sexual revolution and feminism are not the same thing.
No, they're not the same thing. You know, the 60s is so interesting. We're just coming up to that anniversary now, aren't we? I mean, we'll be sick of it by the end of it. But everything is happening in the 60s. And I was just looking at and seeing, well, what was happening? And I saw, you know, the pill is approved for use in 1960. But Valium is too. So you've got women who are suddenly sexually available, but also docile. So they won't be yelling at you, you know, if you're no good in bed. And that seems to me to be interesting. In 1963, Betty Friedan publishes The Feminine Mystique, which is really the beginning of the women's war whoop to say, we're not going to take this anymore. Because the sexual revolution was often about making women available, but it wasn't about making them feel sexually secure or even sexually potent in their own right. It's still about the male.
And does Henry Miller now seem like a classic? Does he seem dated? How good a writer was he in your estimation?
Do you know, he doesn't seem dated. I mean, when I was reading it, of course, you get angry with him because you think, I cannot be just a piece of tale, which is all women are in Miller. All women are there for is to provide cash when the man hasn't got any and to sleep with him when he wants to. Nothing else ever happens to you in Henry Miller if you're a woman. So naturally, you feel a little defeated by this after pages and pages of it, and you wish you had some agency. Nevertheless, it was a book that was ahead of its time. The writing is incredibly fresh. It's powerful. It's clean. It's stripped out. You know, we think about that when we read Hemingway. You know, we love it that all that artificiality has gone, all that self-consciousness has gone. And that's really there in Henry Miller. And it reads like now. It reads very strong. It reads very powerfully. It does not feel dated. And, you know, you have to give the guy his due. He could do that.
Did this surprise you that when you went back and reread it, as you say, you know, one grows, changes over time, and we come at the books we thought we knew in very different ways. Were you surprised by how powerful a writer he still is?
Yes, I was. I was also quite cross about it because naturally you fight with your own prejudices, don't you? And you know that the guy has got it completely wrong and has also done quite a lot of damage talking about women like this. But, you know, you have to put that alongside, in parallel with, the fact that he was in that book, and he wasn't subsequently, I don't believe, a really good writer. He did something very interesting. So one of the things we need to do as readers and as writers is to challenge our own prejudices. You know, you don't have to like something to recognise its worth. You know, you have to recognise sometimes that things are better than you want them to be and also that they give you a hard time because you don't want them to be that good. And so for me, I'm always forcing myself to challenge my own assumptions about writing. And that way, I think, you know, we get a better view, a more total view of what our imaginations are.
And Jeanette, you've said that Henry Miller essentially was writing a kind of fictionalized autobiography, maybe dramatized and glorified in some ways. What has Frederick Turner given us in this book? Does he fill out our understanding of who Miller was and what he was about, or at least as far as this one important novel went?
Yeah, he's right to want to talk about Miller again. I know, I do think we need to keep Miller on the agenda, and we need to keep arguing about what he does, just as we need to keep arguing about the psyche and sexuality of the American male, which is very disturbing. You think, do you guys really think like this? Surely not. But what Frederick Turner does, and this is the thing that I think is most interesting in his study, is that he places Henry Miller within a tradition. You know, he puts him next to Mark Twain. He puts him next to Walt Whitman. Says, you know, this is the renegade of the guy. He said, you know, he wants the big picture. He wants the colourful language. He wants to live outside of the niceties of life. He wants life as it really is, whether it's Mark Twain down at the Mississippi, you know, with the dockhands on the river. He wants to hear how people speak, how they talk, how they feel. He wants the sweat. You know, he doesn't just want the nice things. And I like that. And, you know, and he looks at Whitman and said, you know, here's Whitman saying, you know, whoever touches this book touches a man. And he says that's what Henry Miller wanted. He wanted you to touch through the necessary artifice of prose into the beating heart of the man. And he succeeds there. And because Frederick Turner is passionate about Miller, you can't help enjoying that story and following it with him. There are problems, of course, because when Turner says that Henry Miller tells us about the human condition, tells us about the we that we are, you have to think, well, the we that we are includes women, and it doesn't tell me much about about myself. It tells me a lot about the guys. So there are those things that he forgets about. But also, you know, I want writers to be passionate. I want them to care about their subject matter. I mean, we're not on this life for very long, so we, you know, we may as well care about what we do. And the feeling with Turner is that this is a man who's passionate about Henry Miller, and therefore it's exciting to read it.
Thanks so much, Jeanette.
Thank you.
That's Jeanette Winterson, who reviews Renegade, Henry Miller and the Making of Tropic of Cancer on the cover of this week's book review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is Boomerang, Travels in the New Third World by best-selling author Michael Lewis. The Times' Machiko Kakutani says no one writes with more narrative panache about money and finance than Lewis. That's Boomerang by Michael Lewis. It's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Jonathan Galassi is one of America's most distinguished publishers and also translators of poetry. Now he has his own first book of poems. They won't be published until March, but my distinguished predecessor and admired colleague, Charles McGrath, the Times' writer-at-large, has a story about Galassi and how he came to write these unusual poems. Welcome, Chip.
Thanks. I have to correct you, Sam, if you don't mind.
Yes.
It's not his first book of poems. It's his third. And what's interesting is that the book represents a real advance and change over the previous two books. Stylistically, it's different. The lines are shorter and quicker. And this book has a story to tell. It's a story of a middle-aged man, a married middle-aged man, who discovers that he's gay and then acts upon that discovery.
These are confessional.
They're not confessional exactly in the way, say, that Robert Lowell's poems are confessional, but the speaker of these poems is Jonathan Galassi, or a version of him, yes. And he said to me in an interview that he had always used poetry as a way to explain his own life to himself. And I think a lot of these poems came upon him in a rush when he was in the throes of this experience, which I think was very exciting, very revelatory, and also very painful. He wound up leaving his wife of more than 30 years.
And as you say in your excellent profile, Chip, it's not simply the stimulus of Jonathan Galassi, this very distinguished literary man, discovering a new sexual side of himself. It's also that Galassi is kind of a straight-laced guy. I mean, as you say, he's sort of the last great man in publishing who shows up to work every day in a suit and tie. Was this revelation news in the publishing and literary world?
Yes, it was. And for a while, it was a little bit of gossip, in fact, because it's widely believed, and Galassi doesn't deny it, it's widely believed that the person with whom he fell in love was Bill Clegg, who is an agent now in New York, was an agent in New York, but who had a very well-publicized bout with meth and crack and alcohol addiction. He wrote his own memoir about this experience last year. And if Galassi is the straightest of straight arrows, Bill Clegg was the baddest of bad boys. He's now reformed. So it was a very unlikely pairing, which did heat up the gossip lines for a while. Though, as Galassi says, you know, the Gawker blog moves on, and it's no longer a story, and it has made no difference to his professional life whatsoever. He still remains, as you say, one of the most admired publishers in New York, particularly admired because he runs a house, Ferris Strauss, that manages to make money and also to uphold very high literary standards.
And Chip, Galassi also has a reputation for being really one of the preeminent translators of our time. He's translated some of the great Italian poets. Leopardi most recently, and became famous for translations of Eugenio Montale, right. Both very difficult poets. Does Galassi's own poetry show any of their influence?
He says that it does, but for the life of me, I can't see much resemblance. I mean, the Montale, which is the great thing that he's done and the thing that he will be remembered long when the rest of us have forgotten, is a very difficult poet. He's elusive, and he writes in a kind of private language that even in Italian is sometimes hard to decipher. And the virtue of Galassi's poems is that they're very straightforward and plain-spoken and unadorned, unpretentious. They kind of mean what they say. There may be subtler music effects going on, but Galassi's not this kind of private poet that Montale is. And this, if Montale would have written this book, it would be very different. You wouldn't be able to detect the plot, as I call it, quite so clearly.
Thanks so much, Chip.
Welcome.
That was Charles McGrath, writer-at-large at the New York Times, discussing Left-Handed Poems by Jonathan Galassi. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the nonfiction side of the hardcover lists, there's only one new book, but it enters all the way at number one. That is Ameritopia by the right-wing talk show host Mark Levin. It purports to be a history of utopian ideas going all the way back to Plato and Thomas More. And from there, it ends up really being an attack on idealism and, of course, President Obama arguing that the attempt to create utopias always ends up compromising liberty and turning into a kind of fascism.
So Obama is not really the Kenyan usurper we've heard about. He's actually a Neoplatonist.
in this book, that's right.
What else have we got? What about fiction?
On the fiction side of things, the number one title is not a new book. It's James Patterson with his private number one suspect book that moves back into number one.
I'm sorry, what's that name again? Patterson?
The highest ranking new title is by Bernard Cornwell at number two. It's Death of Kings, which is a book in his Saxon history. It's a Cornwell is a British historical novelist. He did a series of books about a fighter in the Napoleonic Wars, but this goes all the way back to the Middle Ages and looks at kind of the formation of England. This book's about King Alfred the Great.
Right. These are hugely popular novels.
Yeah,
right?
They really are. They all become bestsellers. That's at number two. Then moving down the list, Elmore Leonard has a new bestseller, Raylan, at number seven. Orson Scott Card, the science fiction writer, has a new book in his Ender's Game series, Shadows in Flight, new at number eight. And Nevada Barr has a new mystery in her Anna Pigeon series at number nine called The Rope.
Greg, now you wrote a bit about Card in your column.
I did. You know, he's an interesting guy for a few reasons. For one thing, just on the professional level, he's the only author ever to win both of science fiction's top awards, the Hugo and the Nebula, for 2 years running, which he did with Ender's Game in 1985, and then its sequel, Speaker for the Dead, the next year. And he writes a ton. He's like Stephen King that way. He's maybe 60 years old, and he has something like 50 books to his name. Though only a handful have made the bestseller lists. In fact, Ender's Game itself, which is the book that made him famous and has become a real cult classic, it only made the list something like 20 years after it was published. But the other reason Card is interesting right now especially is that he's an outspoken Mormon, and he doesn't shy away from political debates. So he opposes gay marriage. He's gotten into some trouble with fans over that. Video game came out for the Xbox based on one of his books, and there was a boycott attempt among the gay community. He's also a global warming skeptic, though he's no big supporter of fossil fuels. He's got kind of complicated beliefs politically that are often tied to his Mormon faith. He stepped into the Republican presidential race back in May when the former candidate John Huntsman tried to equivocate about his own Mormonism. I don't know if you remember that. He said, oh, you know, it depends. There are varying degrees. Huntsman
this was Huntsman.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Card wrote an op-ed for a Utah newspaper saying, look, you are or you aren't. There are no varying degrees. Either you believe the tenets of the faith or you don't.
Does Card live in Utah?
No. In fact, he lives in Greensboro, North Carolina, and he writes a column for a weekly newspaper there. He calls the column Uncle Orson Reviews Everything, and that's a pretty accurate title. He just spouts off about whatever's on his mind, from Christian rock bands to high school theater productions to English pronunciation to politics. He also writes another occasional column for the paper where he tackles world affairs, world events. And in that column, he said that he admires and respects Mitt Romney as a fellow Mormon, but he actually prefers Newt Gingrich for president.
Poor Mitt. He can't even get the Mormon vote. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.